From Daylight, I'm Kazuki Akiba.
I'm Brandon Weiser.
And this is Sayonara Baseball. This is a podcast where you and I find unseen baseball gems by analyzing them alongside different trends, news, and motivation behind many moves around the league today.
On today's episode, we'll discuss the Cincinnati Reds, the San Diego Padres, and recount how baseball lifted our spirits after September 11, 2001. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Sayonara Baseball. Today is Friday, September 3rd, 2021. As always, we begin with the news, and we'll start with the friends of the show, the friends of the podcast news. Our softball team in New York City, Forbes Softball, like as we said in our last episode, clinched the playoffs. Playoffs are scheduled for Sunday, September 12th, barring any weather gaps or delays, which has happened before. Good luck to our friends as they go for another champion, as they go for the championship this year, which will be the first in team history. So we wish them best of luck. Another thing that we mentioned last time, we mentioned about the IIHF Women's Ice Hockey World Championships. They have concluded, which finished as always in dramatic fashion with Team Canada beating Team USA 3-2 in overtime in Calgary. The game-winning goal was scored by Captain Canada Marie-Philippe Poulin, assisted by my fellow classmate at Cornell, Brianne Jenner. So congratulations to all the fellow Cornellians. That would be Coach Doug Dara, Brianne Jenner, Rebecca Johnston, Jill Saulnier, Kristen O'Neill, and Jamie Bourbonnais from Team Canada. Also from the other teams that were playing, Sarah Nee, who played on Team Hungary, Lenka Sardar, who played on Czech Republic. This was the first time Team Canada won since 2012, which was taking place in Burlington, Vermont, and I was there. So it was just like a very happenstance that like the one time I was really paying attention and they really had to do this. I've watched every series since I was at Cornell, and they now win last time since Burlington, Vermont. And over now to the baseball news. We'll start with the youth again. We'll start the Little League World Series, concluded late in August. Taylor, Michigan Little League won the Little League World Series. It was a joy to watch. We'll go to Gavin Weir on Team South Dakota, who was pitching absolute gems every game. And then watching Ella Bruning on the team from Texas play what I would call the hockey goalie style of catcher. Like it felt like she was blocking everything, which is incredible. I saw one very heartwarming moment, and I'll relate it here from a team that actually got eliminated pretty quite early. It was Manchester, Connecticut. Manchester, Connecticut was a New England team. They were playing in their elimination game against the Mid-Atlantic team, also elimination game, Toms River, New Jersey, which was the team that Tom Frazier and now his nephew represented. The game was quite close. And then in the fifth inning, these games are only six innings, Toms River scored eight runs, and they scored them fast. On the mound for Team Connecticut was Ryan Gorman. Remember, these kids are 11 or 12 years old. Gorman was on the mound for most of these runs. And after New Jersey scored and get another run, I think they had reached their 11th total run in the game. Gorman you could see his face just kind of sink down because he realized that his team was kind of without hope at this point. They're down many, many runs. A mercy rule could apply. And I would say he honestly looked just visibly distraught. The next batter he faced, he hit him on the back. And we can all, like Kazuki right now is grimacing at the thought because we all know how hard that feels and how much it hurts, be it from 60 feet, 6 inches or 46 feet from these young men and women. He looked like he had seen a ghost. To watch he looked like he was about to cry. And we can probably imagine every major league player, male or female, softball, baseball, when you throw at someone and you do not mean to, you hit them, it probably feels like one of the worst feelings as a pitcher. And his team came up and talked to him. They had a meeting on the mound. And I give credit to Arlen Payment, who was the first baseman, number 28. He walked over to him and put his hands on his shoulders and just kept saying, "You're gonna be okay. We're gonna be okay. Not we're gonna win." Right? Just looked like he kept saying, "We're gonna be okay." And then the coach talked to him, and then Payment said another couple things to him. And then Gorman comes out, and the next batter gets a ground out to third. Third baseman tags the base, inning over, and they lost. But like I think that level of sportsmanship and camaraderie and teamwork is what we always want to see from the League World Series. So it was a refreshing moment to watch. And then we'll go back to the big leagues. Trevor Bauer, still administrative leave. It's extended to at least through today. So we'll see what happens. Presumably it'll be extended again. I presume my suspicions are he'll never pitch for the LA Dodgers again this season, maybe ever. So we'll see how that goes. And according to Brooke Smith from Dodgers Nation and a corroborating report from ESPN, the Pasadena Police Department has finished their investigation, which means the findings will now be reviewed and then released. Reese Hoskins, if we go to Philadelphia now, has been shut down for the season with an abdominal injury and will not play again this season. Corey Kluber came back for the Yankees, according to Dan Martin of the New York Post. He pitched against the Angels, didn't fare so well. They lost the game in what was a losing streak for the Yankees before they came back and won the final game of the series. But Kluber's back, and we'll see how that means for the team. Other New York news, Mets broadcaster Howie Rose, who we'll revisit at the end of our show today, has decided to take a leave from the team for the remainder of the season and focus on a medical procedure that will keep him away from the team until the beginning of next year. So we hope to see him back in 2022. And then we traveled to the Pacific Northwest because what's a show between Kazuki and I without a little Seattle Mariner news? Mariners GM Jerry Dipoto, manager Scott Service, both have signed contract extensions, which we kind of expected to happen as they were doing quite well. So we'll see how that goes.
There's a bigger one. Jerry got promoted as president of baseball operations.
Right.
Which first was the one in Mariners history.
Right. Because as you all remember, the whole saga of where they fired the one executive, then they hired someone, and she is now business operations. So they split that role in two, baseball business. So they hired someone for business, and she has a decorated resume. I mean, she was we have her name on our show list, and I forgot her name. She was the president of business operations for the Atlanta United, probably one of the most successful MLS teams of the last 5-6 years, which was remarkable that they were able to get her to come across the country. So that's great. And now we have, on the baseball side, we have Dipoto. So it seems like they're making the right moves here. So we'll see how that goes. That's the Mariner news. That's good news. And then late breaking today on September 3rd, Friday, we saw that Barstool Sports, a company that we talked about in our last episode about how they're trying to make inroads on broadcasting live sports, has announced they'll have a channel that is debuting today on Sling TV. That was according to Max Willens from Digiday. And what this basically does is Barstool, along with other platform type networks, have taken, like, they've had radio networks like VSIN has, this Vegas Sports Information Network, will have like a platform for radio, then they might have one for video. And they used to have, according to the report, according to Tubular Labs measurement, 79% of Barstool's videos are predominantly occur on Facebook. And they're hoping to move that to a platform where you have to pay money for it. Sling TV is a paid subscription TV streaming service. So that's what we'll see. And this may be that first step to getting live baseball on a network that's like Barstool or a sports gambling network. We'll see, like VSIN or another network like that could also do it. And also we have seen other things like even Peacock, we mentioned last time, NBC Sports, they have connections now to a sports gambling and sports betting. So we'll see how all these networks try to bid for league rights and tie in sports gambling a little bit.
I didn't want to go back to the Mariners. Now, her name is Katie Greggs, who's in the new business operations for the Seattle Mariners.
She came from Atlanta United. So she is not, yep. She was not a previous, I think she may have some experience in baseball, but previously she had built out one of the most successful Major League Soccer franchises in the league's 25-year history. I mean, she found a way along with that coaching staff in Atlanta to put 70,000 people in the deep South for a soccer game. And I will tell you, that is a feat that is not gone unnoticed around all of sports in the world, let alone from the Seattle Mariners, a team that has always, quote unquote, struggled with attendance and struggled with a lot of business operations, to go and get probably the best person in soccer in America just to come over and do it. So now we have secured future a little bit on the field. We'll see for the Seattle Mariners. But yeah, Katie Greggs is now the business operations and Jerry Dipoto is baseball operations. So we'll see how that split of duties from what happened earlier in the Mariners' history allows them to succeed. And with that, we'll end the news and go into the cycle for today and then the rest of the segment. So today's show, on the cycle, we're going to break down several teams, predominantly the Reds and the Padres. And then we're going to go into the schedule. Because if you remember in our last episode, Kazuki and I talked about how a bad team can ruin a good team's year. So we took a look at all the bad teams, the teams that were basically the bottom of the division or towards the bottom, like 400 winning percentage or worse, and what they could do, we'll see. And then we're going to talk about the Hall of Fame. We'll have taken place when the episode's released. So we're going to talk about the Hall of Fame member inductees. Our tip of the cap this week, we're going straight to the Midwest, home of Tommy Edman, Salvador Perez, the Midwestern gems of the week. So we'll go to them. Our Give Them the Hooks is a series of teams that have just been outrightly just bad in their own little ways, like the Red Sox. They've had some bad luck, and then they've played badly. The Padres firing a coach for whatever reason you can imagine, it seemed like. It wasn't really a rhyme or reason. And then we're back to the Mets, and thumbs down, thumbs up. We've solved that. And then 4:17 a.m., coming home from Steve Cohen's house, pull over on the side of the road in White Plains, New York. Don't want to be there. And someone was there. And now we have more problems with that organization. And then the walk-up song of the show. If you've been following this segment since the time we started it, you know it's taken far too long that we come to arguably the best one of all time. And I'll leave it at that, because that's going to talk about our final segment, our ending segment. This is going to be a hard one for me. I'm sure it'll be a hard one for Kazuki, but we're going to talk about 20 years ago, and that was September 11th, 2001. And baseball was probably one of the most visible public events that took place post 9/11. And we'll talk about a few of the instances that allowed us to do it. And between that and the segment about the song, I'm not sure I'll get it without tears. It's an emotional segment to write. So when we get there, just pick the ride with us and we'll go through it. But with that, we're going to go into the cycle and we're going to talk about the ever-changing nature of the NL wildcard race. Because last time we talked to you, it was pretty clear. Padres and the Dodgers were going to be your wildcard teams. No, that's not the case anymore. It will probably be one of which the Dodgers or the Giants, whoever flip-flops at the top of the NL West. But that second team could be the Padres, the Cardinals, or the Cincinnati Reds, the team that everyone loves to kind of write off, but not too much. But as we kind of alluded to throughout the entire season, the Reds have kind of built the perfect formula, if they were playing well, to do well. During the month of August, they had a schedule that allowed them to dominate the Pirates, Cubs, Marlins. They also beat the Brewers. They added Luis Sessa to the bullpen, which just added a little more stability and strength to that thing. Michael Givens and Jason Lorenzen are now the back end, which allowed Amir Garrett to stop being the disaster that he was. Kind of like how the Yankees had Aroldis Chapman, who was the disaster that he was. But now you have that. And then you start adding up the other pitchers. We're going to get to the hitters in a second, but you have Tyler
Malley
and Wade Miley. I always flip-flop the emphasis on those syllables. But Tyler Malley and Wade Miley have both pitched quite well. Luis Castillo is coming back to his proper form. And I think all of this together on the mound.
And
Sonny Gray. I was watching their game against the Cardinals on MLB Network the other day. It just feels a little different in Great America Ballpark. Just feels a little different. And I think if you transition off the mound to go to the hitters, the one player we talk about, Castellanos, talk about Winker and Votto, Jonathan India is arguably a top candidate for Rookie of the Year. And I think what that means is when you take all those other power hitters and you add one guy who just gets on base, you're getting runs. And they score a lot of runs when they can. And that's what I think between Jonathan India, Nick Castellanos, Jesse Winker, Joey Votto, and Tyler Naquin, you're starting to form a really solid core of players to keep them going. Because I will say that Eugenio Suarez is he's got to improve, because his batting average is really bad. He's a good player when he plays. Same with Mike Moustakas, is when he's healthy, he's fantastic. And I think all those players together, we have something here to really do something. And I think the other question that I pose to you, Kazuki, is how much can we expect from an improvement in terms of Suarez and Moustakas? Because they should be quite good. They really haven't been good or Moustakas available.
Moustakas, as long as he could improve his availability, I think he'll improve the team significantly. Suarez, I'm not as optimistic. He seems like he was a product of the juice ball, unfortunately. He had his amazing 2019 where he hit 49 home runs. Ever since then, 2020 and this year, he has the power. He just doesn't make good contact. It's a lot of lazy fly balls and pop-ups, or he just strikes out way, way too much. And I think the fact that he was playing around with different defensive positions like shortstop may have screwed his psyche a little bit. So I'm not sure if there's a way to fix
that. We've seen that with a couple
Suarez
other players, that when you get swapping around defensively, it affects you offensively. Obviously, because you mentally have to devote more time to each element of the game. But I would say Jonathan India has kind of been that love, that new factor that you didn't have previously to kind of balance out a poor performance of one player, which is what we've always discussed. If you're going to have a player that's going to perform under their expectations, you got to have one that overperforms. And Jonathan India has done that in spades for that team.
And he replaced Nick Senzel, who's supposed to be the original guy with speed and like at the top of the lineup being the table setter. But because he's not available, you have Jonathan India.
Right. And there you go. And you have Nick Castellanos, who has played, it seems like, who has always been on like bad teams, is now on a good team. It's that's great. And Jesse Winker is like the unsung hero of a lot of that team. Just the thing of he can hit so well when he's on. We always obviously know Joey Votto is a great player. Let's not mince words.
So. He was declining until this year. He had his renaissance somehow. And
that home run streak, the seven.
Exactly.
Innings.
That crazy home run streak. But I think what really helped out is stabilizing that bullpen. I think
right.
You brought that up to me
several times as we were preparing for today about just that bullpen. When you couldn't get from your starters to your closer and your closer was not good anyway, you're losing games in the back end. You can't do that. Because we saw it happen to the Yankees when they had that problem. They would lose a lot of games. And you can't be like that if you want to compete. Because the best part about the Reds in terms of their future, other than the players, they have a pretty easy schedule. They have series. They have three series remaining against Pittsburgh and a series against the Nationals. Both teams who are not anywhere close to the playoffs. We'll get more into those teams later on. But they also have a series against the Dodgers coming up later in September. The White Sox, another tough one. And the Cardinals. They just finished all the Cardinals? I mean, no, the Cardinals, obviously. Remember, the Cardinals are both their division rival and the wild card rival. So they're playing two sides here. So we'll see how that goes. But as we talk about the success of the Reds, we move on to the lack of success for the San Diego Padres. So high on them. But they had three separate four-game losing streaks in August. Four losses in a row to Arizona. Can't do that. One of which I believe was the no-hitter. And then they played Colorado and then went to Philadelphia and lost four games in a row. And then to end the series in Philadelphia and then play the Dodgers, they lost four games in a row. So we have three separate four-game losing streaks. That's not going to bode well. They lost Fernando Tatis Jr. Then they got him back, moved him to the outfield. So it's another realignment of your team. Machado and Cronenworth have not been the top of the lineup hitters that you would want them to be. I think they keep shifting players further and further down the lineup. That top of the lineup is in the bottom lineup are just, they feel completely different. And you provided a great stat for this. Tatis is the one carrying the weight with a 6.6 war based on a 162 game average. That's insane. That's so high. I mean, Cronenworth has a 6. So that's really putting the onus on two players of very different strengths, I will say too. I mean, how can you do that? Like, how can you create a lineup that is that unbalanced?
It's just the veterans. They're just not productive. Will Myers and Eric Hosmer, Tommy Pham, also another factor. Like,
they got Jake Marisnyk. Jake Marisnyk, I don't feel, hasn't played.
And the worst one, I think you already will talk about, is Adam Frazier. Like, your trade deadline, like, pieces are not
even
working.
He's batting eighth. Like, he should be batting like second, maybe.
Probably third. Leadoff. Yeah.
Leadoff. And he just can't get up there. And like,
There were indication of regression, but not to this extent. I mean, his BABIP was very high, but we did not expect him to like not be even an average like level player.
All right, let's go through the lineup kind of quickly. Like you mentioned, Tommy Pham, Will Myers, and Fernando Tatis Jr. the outfield, and then that's an unbalanced set.
And then Trent Grisham as well, and who's Grisham, been in and out.
Right, and then you have the infield. You have Machado, Tatis Jr., Cronenworth, Hosmer. That's an unbalanced set. Your catching has been
Nola,
but
not Nola.
You want to put it all on Aaron, all on Nola, on Austin Nola to be your tables to be your consistent player. That's a lot to ask of anyone, let alone the person who's probably not going to be playing every day. I mean, it's just a lot of it's a very imbalanced lineup. And then you go to the pitching, and they just have injury after injury after injury. And we're going to talk about what the injuries meant really to them later on. But Snell and Darvish are getting there. You provided you want to read that the update you provided me about Darvish and his ERA, because it's just been staggering.
Yeah, I mean, Darvish since the All-Star break, so he's been sporting an ugly 7.57 ERA in 9 starts since July 3rd. So he had an ERA of 2.44 that got raised to 4.05 over that time span. And that included that 2 poor outings against the Diamondbacks where he didn't even escape the third inning.
Right. And then look at other performances on that team. Blake Snell is hopefully coming back in form a little bit, but Joe Musgrove led the team with nine wins until the end of the month of August.
And then he's been getting hit. I think, you know, this could be an issue of either they're injured, especially Darvish, he could be injured, or is it due to the, you know, substance crackdown?
The changes with the grips and everything, like Glasnow said, like if you're changing your grip so much, you're going to be a whole different person. And then you go to their bullpen. It's like Mark Melancon is a very good pitcher. But to get to him has been just such a struggle with Lamet, Paddock, Pomerantz, and Strom all injured. Not performing well, some combination of. And they got Arrieta, and Arrieta's back injured again. And it's just been up and down. It's not going to help when you can't get any level of consistency from that team. And you look at their schedule, and it's tough. I mean, they're facing the Astros this weekend, so we'll see how that pans out time side if it was released. Then they face the Cardinals and the Braves outside of their own division. And their division is not easy because, as we're going to discuss, go into a second, the Colorado Rockies are a very different team where you play them at home versus on the road. So if you play the Colorado Rockies in Denver, that's like playing a top level team, it feels like, compared to the Colorado Rockies elsewhere, which is a not top level team. So on the Padres, anything else there other than the fact that it feels like it's like two sets of scales and it just keeps going up and down every week. And they need to get in that level set. And they just have not found a way to do that since the trade deadline.
I would say it's just on a steep decline. Like, they just have no momentum. They just are frustrated, clearly, but it just isn't working. Like, nothing's working for them. And
not at all.
Problem is, like, if their pitching's bad, the hitting got to carry, but nothing's working for them. So, like, what are they going to do? Like, because if Darvish isn't healthy, you lost your number one at this point. Number one starter, and then your hitter, if Tatis is slumping or Cronenworth is slumping, who's going to carry the weight? Machado hasn't really done that this year.
No, I agree. You're not going to get, you're not, if you're going to have one person fall, you have the other to lift them up. And they have not been able to do that on a consistent basis. That's as simple as that. And we'll get more into like the failings of that team too in our Give Them the Hook segment later on. But now we're going to talk about this concept that Kazuki and I have gone back and forth about for weeks, about what bad teams could ruin a good team's year. Because as we have seen, that the races are extremely tight for especially wildcard spots now. They've gotten tighter and tighter and tighter as we've seen through the month of August. Especially in the NL East, NL West, AL East, and AL West. You have tight tops, and then you have even tighter wildcard races in those overall leagues. Therefore, we ask the simple question, which bad team could cause the most turmoil to the better teams? And we've outlined several teams. We'll run through them quickly, but some of them we've got to focus on. I think we're focused a lot on the AL, on the NL West, because their schedules are significantly more impactful, I feel like. Colorado, they split a lot of their games in September between the NL West and NL East. They have a home and an away series. So all of their games of the year against Atlanta. Atlanta's in a tight race. They have an away series at Philadelphia. Philadelphia's in a tight race. But we obviously said, if Colorado plays you away, you should feel a little bit easier on it. Same with San Francisco. But San Francisco has two series with Colorado, but they're both at Denver. LA, the Dodgers have a series at Denver. So those are at least probably 8 to 12 games where it's coming into Denver to maintain a position in your division. That's not going to be easy at all.
Considering how the ball travels out there, no.
And between CJ Cron and Trevor Story, that ball is going to fly there. And everyone turns up to a different level when you're playing in Denver, let alone the home team. I don't know what's going to happen there. But I think they could definitely spoil a lot of people's hopes. Diamondbacks, who ruined the Padres a little bit. What else can they do? Well, they have a series versus Atlanta. They also have a home and away series with both the Dodgers and an interleague series with the Mariners. I am not a huge fan of the Mariners going down to Arizona to play a game because that ballpark is tricky enough. You send a team there with just a little bit of fluidity. That's not going to be good, but it could be great. We'll see. Maybe they beat them up and hit a couple games. The Diamondbacks also play the Giants. And the Giants, as we can see, one bad game is going to matter a lot in that division with the Dodgers so close to them now.
Considering so, they're tied for the division lead.
There you go. And it was like 17 hours it changed and that came back and they're tied. So any one game mattered. One game does matter with them. Move to the AL West. Texas Rangers, the bottom. Like they are dead bottom. They have a series at New York, and then they have series with both Houston and Oakland. And let me tell you, those three series now feel a lot larger than they did maybe a month ago because Yankees have a shot now because Boston is falling. Houston and Oakland are so tightly wound up at the top there now that that matters. And the Mariners are getting ever inching closer and closer. They're good dashing some hopes. I don't think it'll be as significant as Arizona or Colorado, but that impact could be felt, I think, in multiple venues.
I mean, the Rangers did win a series against Houston not so long ago.
There you go. That's one. That's all you need. All you need is one. And then we go to the tanking Baltimore Orioles of the AL East. Talk about a East heavy schedule. They have two series versus the Yankees, two versus Toronto, two versus Boston. And again, we see the Phillies come about. The Phillies need to definitely beat up on these teams, these bad teams. But to their own AL East contenders, any of those series, if they go sideways, good luck trying to recover from it. I mean, Boston did that against Detroit. It went sideways, and ever since then, it's gone downhill. I think that one could be a little bit disastrous to the AL East in the wild card race. Again, I don't think it's going to be as significant as what Colorado can do. Colorado, I think, right, by far has the highest level of potential impact to these schedules of these teams that are contending. Pittsburgh, three series against Cincinnati, and then Philadelphia again. That series against Cincinnati, just Cincinnati's got to win them all. They've got to win all of them because they have to keep staying ahead of St. Louis and San Diego. Again, the Phillies are playing a bunch of bad teams. Just beat them. You got to beat them.
And they have to play catch up. Like, literally, they're only two games behind the division.
Right. And they have the Braves. We're talking about the Braves again. The Nationals play the Mets, the Braves, the Reds, and the Red Sox. Again, we see that the Braves need to beat up on bad teams, but also that the Reds need to be up on bad teams. Boston needs to be up on bad teams. At the same time, this team in particular has Juan Soto. Like, he could mess you up. That team has players that can mess you up in terms of just providing runs and making pitchers' lives absolute nightmares, especially at Nationals Park. So, again, that one could provide a little bit of crumbs along the way and kind of disrupt people. The Marlins, Philadelphia, two series, the Mets, Atlanta, and they play Tampa. If I'm looking at that, the Marlins right now, my thing is go against New York and just beat them up. Just beat up the Mets. you've caused enough problems to them in that double header a couple of days ago at the end of August. Just beat them up. If you beat up the Mets are gone. The Mets are a sinking ship with a lot of, in terms of internally, a lot of things. They got turned around internally. But if you can put a bad team and beat them up, do it. Get some runs, get some good scoring, and just level the Mets off the playing field. And just leave it basically between the Braves and the Phillies to finish the season off of the NL East. That, I think, is what could happen very clearly with that. And then we'll go to the Cubs, who is basically, how much more can Patrick Wisdom do for you? Because that man has been an absolute gem since the trade deadline. But he's not designed to make a team contend for the playoffs, but he could ruin a lot of playoff series because they play the Reds, the Giants, twice against the Cardinals, and here we go with Philadelphia again. So Philadelphia has a lot of bad teams. Cincinnati has a lot of bad teams they're playing against. I would say they are the most likely to lose ground if they lose to those teams. So I think that's what, of all the scenarios I talk about, I would say the team that could provide the most impact of the bad teams that are hurting people, one is Cincinnati, two is probably Arizona, and three is the Cubs. The teams that could definitely benefit the most from their schedule, it's two of them, the Phillies and the Braves. I think the Reds are kind of like in the middle, but like the NL East is so tight that if you can beat up on those bad teams, you're a sweet head. I kept saying those names over and over and over again. Those are the teams that need to do the best. What do you think? That's my thing.
Well, yeah, Phillies is supposed to have the easiest schedule out of all of them, so they need to really capitalize on these. I know they have a very bad history against the Marlins. They always lose a series to Marlins, and that cost them the playoff appearance last year. And it could potentially, because Marlins is not really a bad team. They just are inconsistent. Like, their pitching is amazing. So if they could beat that up, I mean, so far, Phillies have capitalized where they've been on a 6-game winning streak. So they are 2 games back of the Braves. So they just have to keep winning. They just can't afford to lose this momentum going in September, or else like they spend so much money for nothing. Especially with Dombrowski running that baseball ops.
You got Kennedy and Gibson. You went out and you went big for it. They gotta win. I mean, I'm watching Braves highlights and Braves games and seeing Adam Duvall just absolutely destroy the baseball. I was like, they have the most potential to really beat this team and go through all these teams. But like I said, they have that series between we saw the Braves play the Dodgers. That was a great series. The Braves now have to play two series against Colorado. The Rockies at home are basically as good as any team at home. And that ballpark is confusing enough to begin with. And then you throw in the fact that they have to go back and play them again later in the month. Whichever way those series orient themselves, either way, one's going to be more challenging than the next. Good luck on that one. Because the right. Braves occurred in almost all of our noteworthy teams of like teams that could change your future kind of thing. But I'm curious to see how this unfolds. But well, next time we record an episode, a couple of weeks, we'll know a lot more about these series because I think most of it will have happened. And if I were just to make my awful prediction right now, I would say the teams that are going to be coming out of this so far better than the other are the Reds, the Braves, and probably the Giants. I think the teams that are not going to come out of this well are the Phillies and the Red Sox and the Yankees. I think that those three teams are going to get just, it's not going to end well with the AL. The AL East is going to get even more confusing.
Yeah, I think it's a three-team race. I mean, we all know Tampa's going to get that division. It's just a matter of who's going to get that first wild card spot, and it is between the Red Sox or the Yankees, because Oakland right now is also inconsistent as well, but you never know as Oakland. Seattle is a surprising team. We want to be confident that they're going to be good, but I think numbers and everything doesn't lie, and I don't think they will kind of go that far, but you never know with chaos ball, right?
Right.
The fun differential.
We'll end our discussion there with chaos ball is measured by a fun differential, as they say in Seattle. And I think that's the way you talk about a good team, by fun differential. Love our Seattle Mariners. And with that, we'll end our current baseball talk, and we'll talk about something that's going to happen for the first time in 2 years. It will happen on Wednesday, September 8th, as we as those who are celebrating the Jewish New Year of Rosh Hashanah will be celebrating also the Baseball Hall of Fame induction from 2020, delayed 1 year. And we'll go through some of the notable names that are getting inducted. We'll start with the award winner. So the Frick Award, which is given to a media person, media and broadcaster. There are two names, Al Michaels and Ken the Hawk Harrelson. If you've watched sports for the last number of years, you know who both these names are. We'll go into Michaels. Both these, by the way, have had specials done on MLB Network called Sounds of Baseball, which I've watched, and they're very interesting. Michaels in particular, because Al Michaels came to baseball as the play-by-play announcer for the Reds in the 1971. And when he called the World Series with the Reds, national broadcasts had this very polite and kind of nice rule where they would split the analysts. They would split the home broadcaster would call it for one team and they would switch the analysts. So Al Michaels called games on NBC as the Reds broadcast when the Reds were at a certain level in certain games. And that was with NBC's Kurt Gowdy, who's phenomenal in his own right. So it was just an interesting pairing. And then he moved on to San Francisco. And then he joined ABC Sports 1977. And if you all remember 1977, 1980 with ABC Sports, that's Miracle on Ice. That's part of his progression there. But he also called baseball games with ABC when ABC carried MLB games. Most notably in this was the 1989 World Series in the Bay Area where the earthquake occurred. And he was on the mic when that game occurred. And I listened to that call a couple of times with Sounds of Baseball and afterwards. It just sounds frightening. So like that we feel an earthquake and there was an earthquake and then the game just stops because the bridge is, the highway's collapsing around them. It's just something you never want to hear. And we'll talk about how things have changed from a really tough spot and disasters of all levels and changes later on. But he saves ABC. They lost the rights to cover Major League Baseball. So he does probably football for Monday Night Football and then goes to NBC for Monday Football where he is currently and also the Olympics. And then Ken the Hawk Harrelson. Kazuki, have you ever heard him call a game?
No, I haven't, unfortunately.
Oh, it's great. If you're a former WGN sports subscriber before they became WGN America, when WGN was a superstation like TBS, you could get White Sox and Red Sox and White Sox and Cubs games. And you would get Harry Carey at the mic for the Cubs and Ken the Hawk Harrelson calling games with Steve Stone, who still calls with Jason Benetti, by the way. And he called the games for 25 years up until 2018. And he had some very colorful ways, I would say, and very fun ways of calling games. Like I will do my best Hawk impression as we can on our podcast recording right now. And when someone struck out, I go, he gone. And it was like this very, like, it's like,
oh, sorry. White Sox. Yes. Yes. Right. I have heard of him. Yes. So yes.
You hear he gone. Like, you know, it. And it's like,
yes.
When you hear the home run calls, like get up. And it's like, it's just, he's just trying so hard. I remember those are Robbie Ventura, Harold Baines, Frank Thomas. Oh, all
I
those
remember
guys.
All those from the 2005 season, actually, when they won their World Series in a while.
Mark Burley striking out people every time, like that kind of thing. I mean, so it's now it's Jason Benetti who's great. I love Jason Benetti behind the mic for that team. And also they have Benetti was out on leave for a couple of games while he was at the Olympics and then he was ill afterwards. Mike Monaco stepped in. I just never heard of Mike Monaco. Mike Monaco called games to the World Series. So the White Sox have a good cachet of broadcasters. And now they also have Len Casper on radio, who used to be on the Cubs side. So like Chicago, great broadcasting, but the Hawk really meant something. But the best part about the Hawk recently was when La Russa was hired as the coach, Hawk basically served as a short-term executive for the team. The one move that he was most known for is firing Tony La Russa. He fired Tony La Russa. And then as soon as the Hawk is beyond the mic, he is retired from broadcasting, they hired La Russa back as their manager. All the things. So I think that's just a fun little nugget. I love watching those games when you get a chance. I will say when like Kazuki gets his MLB TV and I have MLB Network or ESPN Plus as the game of the day, you get to watch the home or away broadcast. And every time it was the White Sox at the time, and they still did that, I would watch those games. I just have them on the background because it's just fun to listen to. The Baseball Writers Association of America Award winners, there were two, Dick Cagle and Nick Cafardo. I'm going to hopefully get that right. I know his son is part of ESPN. Cagle is best known for being one of the best beat writers in the history of Missouri for baseball. He covered both the Cardinals and the Royals for a number of years. He also serves the editor-in-chief of the Sporting News. So that's a pretty remarkable career. With Cafardo, it's a bit of a somber tale to kind of relive. He passed away very tragically during spring training in 2019 while covering the Red Sox. His son wrote a moving tribute for him when that all took place, but he is best remembered for being one of the most intrepid journalists. We talked about Chris Snow, who is now with the Calgary Flames, who's battling ALS, was also an intrepid journalist covering the Red Sox. But Nick Cafardo was like the face of them for the Boston Globe and NESN for years and years and years and years and years. And it was so tragic that he passed away and so untimely. But he's so good. I mean, we love a good beat writer. Like, we, being Mariners fans, follow Ryan Divish of the Seattle Times. And he's quite good. I mean, it's just great to watch him. And I will say in hockey, there's always good ones. In basketball, there's great beat writers. And Nick was that for the Red Sox. It's simple as that. And it's a well, honor well-deserved. And then the Lifetime Achievement Award goes to David Montgomery, who served as the president and CEO of the Philadelphia Phillies up until his passing in 2019 from a battle with cancer. So another person who really meant something to a big community, and he built up the Phillies, and he was there when they won the World Series. So that's great to see.
Was too. Our former GM, Pat Gillick.
Oh, that's right. That's also true. Again, the marriage connection is far and wide. Now we'll go to the induction class. The induction ceremony will induct four members of the class of 2020. We'll start with Marvin Miller, who is the architect of what we now know as free agency. He served as the MLBPA executive director from 1966 to 1982. He most notably helped create free agency, which is basically the thing that we're watching all unfold very quickly as we go along. Just always a remarkable thing to talk about. We talked with Corey earlier in the year about the role of the ILR school with negotiations. What does the union say? Mark Miller was the head of the union for so long. Rob Manfred transitioned from the union side to this commissioner. So you never know what can happen of a person who really matters a lot to the players. And then we'll go into the three players getting inducted. The first of which is Ted Simmons, who I honestly did not know anything about before I read about this. And my goodness, what a career from Ted Simmons. He is one of the best catchers in league history, spending most of his career with the St. Louis Cardinals. According to the Baseball Hall of Fame, these stats blew me away. He batted a collective 285 with 2,472 hits, 483 doubles, 248 home runs, and 1,389 RBIs. He ranks first all time on NL switch hitters list at the time of his retirement with 182 National League home runs. Oh my goodness. That is a crazy career. He also ranks second in hits, doubles, and RBIs, and fifth in runs for among those who have played at least 50% of their career at catcher. That's incredible. And I think he played for a team that definitely competed, which is incredible, which is a great team too. But what a career. I think that's a remarkable career. The final two players are players that Kazuki and I got to see play during our lifetime, which is quite incredible. The first of which is the great Canadian Larry Walker. Larry Walker was supposedly going to be a great junior great hockey player, but that didn't pan out. So he got drafted by the Expos, and then he played with the Expos and later the Rockies. And between 1995 and 2003, on the Rockies, Walker won one home run title with 49 home runs in 1997, three batting titles, two in a row of which, five gold gloves, the NL MVP in 1997. He also, in that same year, like I said, hit 49 home runs, 130 RBIs. He batted 366, a number that seems so difficult to achieve in principle. Like, I haven't seen that in the last, what, 4 or 5 years, I felt like. Maybe Miguel Cabrera could do that again. But that's incredible. He stole 33 bases that year. He had 409 total bases that year, which is the 18th best total in history for the league, according to the Baseball Hall of Fame. I will leave you with a fact. There's a fact on his webs on the page that they're announcing his induction. Larry Walker is one of four players, along with Hank Aaron, George Brett, and Willie Mays, to post a career batting average of 300 or more, with 300 home runs and 200 stolen bases at least. I never thought I would say those four names in a row. I thought I could say, I could hear Brett, Aaron, and Mays, but Larry Walker? Larry Walker didn't win any World Series. He didn't win stuff like that. But he was, wow, his batting average was incredible. And then you paired him up with like Todd Helton later in his career and Vinny Castilla at the Rockies. I mean, that was just a legendary crew. I mean, back in the days of the Expos, he had Tim Raines. Randy Johnson started his career with them too. So like, you think about this, it's, what a legend.
He almost got the World Series. He just got swept as a Cardinal in 04.
Right. That's it. He had swept in 04. I mean, he had the long, flowy hair. Like, he looked like a hockey player playing baseball, and he was. But he batted so well. It was incredible. It was incredible to watch. And the last player, this is a great segue to our, before we head to break, Derek Jeter. His tenure with as an owner of the Marlins, we may all throw some questions at. But his tenure of 2,674 games, his entire career with the New York Yankees, is nothing to question at all. He played every single game he ever played with the Yankees at the same position. Number two, shortstop. Every single game. His most famous plays batting-wise, we're going to talk about one later on in 2001 during the World Series. But in that same year, in the ALDS, it's probably the most memorable play for me. I don't know about you, Kazuki, but I remember that play every single year. Like, they show it every single year in the playoffs. Against Oakland, Jason Giambi. Or is it Jeremy? Jeremy Giambi's at the plate. Not Jason Giambi. Jeremy Giambi's at the plate. I'll read the script as they have written it on Baseball Hall of Fame's website, because it's just, it means so much when you read it out loud, because you start reliving the images in your mind. Down two games to the best of five series and clinging to a 1-0 lead.
So you're not going to run. You're not going to hit and run. You got to wait for a gapper.
That is fair down the right field line. Giambi on his way to third, and they're going to wave him around. The throw misses a cutoff man, shot into the plate, out of the plate. Derek Jeter with one of the most unbelievable plays you will ever see by a shortstop. Were missed. Jeter coming down the line, fielded with his bare hand, a shovel to Posada, and Giambi is out. What an unbelievable
Jeter intercepted an off-target throw near the first baseline from right fielder Shane Spencer on a double by Terrence Long. So if you're thinking about this, Derek Jeter has come all the way across of the diamond to get this ball. The play appeared to get, like, Jeremy Giambi was running from first all the way around. He was going to make it home. And then we see Derek Jeter somehow magically take the ball and just flip it to Jorge Posada. And they got him. A play that should never have ended this way. And Derek Jeter just flips the ball to another player who I hope will be in the Hall of Fame someday, and that's Jorge Posada. But that play is like, you watch that play on repeat year after year after year. It's probably one of the best defensive plays. I mean, and that same, I feel like Derek Jeter's defensive plays are more memorable than some of his offensive plays. He's running into the seats in Oakland, crashing his face and like catching the ball. He had no quit as a shortstop. Like, he played the entire infield, but that one play where he takes the ball from Spencer on the throw, off target. Long has made his way to second. Jeremy Giambi is rounding third, and he just flicks it and gets him.
And time, yeah. And, you know, not to mention, Yankees were down 0-2 in that series, too.
Right, they were down 0-2. They came back, made it to the World Series that year, as we're going to discuss later, and played the Diamondbacks. I mean, that was Moneyball era Athletics, too. I mean, like, this team was... they were down and out, and they came all the way back. And this play just is a signal of that. I mean, just incredible. I mean, I remember that. It's just, the video is great. I mean, you can't beat it. So if you get a chance to watch it, do it.
Coming up after the break, we're going to talk about some slumping teams and then finish strong with how baseball lifted our spirits.
after September 11, 2001.
The Mets are wearing the first responder caps, Luis Rojas in the FDNY cap. We'll see that throughout the night. First time since 2007, the Mets have been allowed to wear those on the field. Pete Alonso, Jeff Wilpon, many others kind of wearing down the commissioner's office to be allowed to put those hats back on.
Welcome back, everyone. We're here on September 3rd. Recounting the last couple weeks in baseball, we're going to our tip of the caps. And this week for our tip of the caps, both Kazuki and I ended up in the state of Missouri. And Kazuki, you're up first. With the man who looks like he is diminutive in stature, but so much more in strength and power. That's Tommy Edman of the St. Louis Cardinals.
Yeah, my pick is Tommy Edman of the St. Louis Cardinals. He just won NL Player of the Week this past week. He batted 462, which is 12 for 26, with 7 runs, 2 homers, 10 RBIs, and 2 stolen bases. And during that time, he registered multiple RBIs in each of the final 4 games of the week, including a 3 RBI effort that let them to win against the Pirates. This man is just a dynamic player, you know, who's been really awesome. He's third in steal behind Trey Turner and Tatis Jr. That's a class to be in. And then I believe he is the key in order for the Cardinals to actually make it into the playoff. He is a key table setter.
I do agree.
And he is going to be the one to push the Cardinals' success. If he could get on base, you'll have Goldschmidt and Arenado knocking him in, and he'll and his defense, versatility in defense, playing second, third in the outfield, even shortstop at times will really help out quite a bit. And right now in the second half, he ranks us, third behind Wainwright and Goldschmidt in terms of WAR in his team. The record right now for the Cardinals 68-64, coming back when they were below 500 for quite some time this season, now gaining some momentum and they're like 2.5 games back of the second wild card race with the Reds, their division rival Reds. So this is going to be significant. So if he could keep on pushing. So during this time in the second half, he compiled a WRC plus of 141 and 112 plate appearances from the left side because he's a switch hitter. So most of his at-bats are against right-handed pitching. So he has to do well on the left side. And that was after he batted a 68 WRC plus, which is very bad and low, which means he did not have much of a productive at bat on the left side. And that was for most of the first half was 305 plate appearances. So him actually having a resurgence in the second half is really showing that without him, Cardinals will not be able to win any games. And it showed clearly that he is the heartbeat of the team. And if the Molina and Wainwright's the soul, he is the machine to drive that soul to that playoff game.
Because if you think about it, you look at that infield, it's anchored by him. He is the anchor on that infield. I mean, he is the top of the infield. You have Arenado and Goldschmidt on the corners every game, no questions. But you have Tommy Edman at the top. And we all have seen the value of a good second baseman and shortstop. I think that matters a lot to them. And then when he gets at the bat, he's doing things that really matter to that team. And I think you said that's absolutely right. He is the game changer for them to get to the playoffs. If he so goes him, I think the team is going to rise with him. So I think that's a great pick. I think we're curious to see how he goes. I'll travel. You're on the east side of the state. I'll go a little bit west. And to our friend Caleb and my friend Zach, I got to give it to Salvador Perez. What he did against the Mariners was bad for the Mariners, but so much fun. I think even the people of Seattle were like, this guy is good. I like watching him. Because who doesn't like watching him? Between him and Molina in the state of Missouri, like the catching is set for...
I mean, he might hit 40 home runs this season. That's how good he is.
So, yeah. And I think what happened was he hit 5 games in a row, 5 home runs. So we'll start with this. In the series versus Houston, before the series against Seattle, hit a solo home run the final game of that series. And then he came to Seattle and not hit a home run every game, 2 of which were grand slams, which in Seattle... they mean something if you hit them on the home team. On the away team, it just feels like it really gets you. He hit a go-ahead grand slam in the first game. They won 6-4. He hit a game-time grand slam in the next game. Royals won 8-7. 2-run home run in the third game. Royals won 4-2. In the last game, the Mariners did not get the sweep. Perez did hit another home run. And with that, he tied a team record held by the legend Mike Sweeney for five consecutive games of five home runs. It was just remarkable to watch. People getting really behind him. People love Salvador Perez in Kansas City. They love all-around baseball. One of the most universally loved players. And it was just really fun to watch. I mean, the Mariners is not great, but it was just great to watch him have that stroke of success. I couldn't take my eyes off of it. It was so much fun to watch. And then we'll move into the not-so-good side. And you have deferred to me on all these picks this week because you basically said in our notes, you picked the two worst. Here's a third throw-in. And like we said earlier, it's the Red Sox, the Padres, and the Mets. So the Red Sox, Kazuki's notes are, they're just bad. Bad, 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 bad. And I'm like, yes, they're bad. They had bad luck. They had the string of COVID outbreak. And then they have players that are out. They get Chris Sale back and they can't keep winning. And then they're falling behind the Yankees and they're falling behind the Blue Jays. They're falling down the Blue Jays. Then they're going lower in the wild card race. So they're just getting lower and lower and lower in their wild card, because they're not going to catch the Rays at this point. So they're just falling and falling and falling. They had bad luck and then a bad play. And I always remember, I will keep going back to this. You bet on Kyle Schwarber. Is he in the lineup yet?
He's been playing. So it's the pitching. Blame the pitching and inconsistency of the rest of the lineup. Like, where is JD Martinez?
Right. And then also you have, you're betting so much on the bullpen. Who got hit by the hardest by the names on the COVID IL are the bullpen. So, I mean, it's just bad luck with the bad play. And it's oil and water. They don't mix together. They don't mix at all. They just make it worse.
It just float.
it just like you have two very bad situations and they just like, I'll stay, keep my distance, but together we're not that great. Padres, you fired Larry Rothschild. Why? Your pitchers weren't bad. They were not great. As you saw, Darvish not great. They're mostly injured. So I called this firing mostly performative. It's like, yeah, fire somebody because everyone's doing badly. Fire the pitching coach who's kind of been around the league enough times to hook another job probably. But it's just been performatively, the pitching for the Padres we talked about earlier, not great. Whole team's not been great, but.
But this is like the third team where he gets like let go of, right? The Cubs, Yankees, right. And now so the Padres.
Exactly. The fire Larry Rothschild move. Let's see how that works. I don't know. And then we'll end with the Mets. This week and a little before that last week, we had the thumbs down and Javi Baez and Francisco Lindor and Kevin Pillar maybe. Like, they had this thumbs down thing about booing the fans when they weren't playing well. And then they came back against the Marlins one day and they got, yay, thumbs up. So it's just just too much contention, too much infighting and everything. And remember that Baez is not guaranteed next year on the team. And who could come back for them is a very interesting player. His name is Robinson Cano. So what are they going to do there? So don't anger yourself to the fans or the front office. And Steve Cohen in his tweets, they keep coming. They're not great. They just keep coming. The fans and the players are not getting along, as we saw earlier. The fans and the ownership are not getting along. And then Zach Scott coming home from a fundraiser at Steve Cohen's house on early Tuesday morning at 4:17 a.m. was arrested and cited for driving while intoxicated while he had parked his car on a main road or on a road in White Plains, New York, according to Mike Puma, Craig McCarthy, and Jorge Fitzgibbon, New York Post. He found sleeping in his car after spending time at a fundraiser in Connecticut at Cohen's home. He was driving while intoxicated, which is just outrightly wrong to begin with. And then he fell asleep in his car at 4:17 a.m. right in front of the police station in White Plains, New York, and was cited for it and will now go to court and have to deal with the consequences of his actions. The GM position of that team already had enough problem with Jared Porter because he was a downright jerk and an idiot and just
disgusting.
Never had a job. It was what he was doing was deplorable, like what he did. And then he has this with Zach Scott. It's like too much turnover, too much turmoil. It's just that's got to leak into the field at some point. And I think I want to leave there because it's just not a fun scenario to watch.
There's like one word I would say about this whole situation: lol Mets.
Yeah, it's just not good. It is so bad. But we're going to turn it around now. Like I said at the top of the show, this part's going to be emotional for me, and I'm sure it's going to, and if Kazuki, when Kazuki chimes in, I'm sure it'll be for him. 20 years ago on the Saturday, maybe after Saturday, this is released, it'll be September 11th, it was 2001. I remember where I was on September 11th, 2001. I was in seventh grade English. My teacher, Mrs. Nickel, had no idea how to explain to a bunch of seventh graders what was happening. I remember I went to the, I asked to go with the excuse, go to the office, call my parents, because I knew of maybe a couple people who are family friends who lived or worked in and around that area. Very luckily, none of them actually were at the World Trade Center that day. None of them were at the Pentagon that day, and none of them were on the plane that was heroically dived into Shanksville, Pennsylvania. But the reverberations from that day, the way I can explain that is it was the first time in my life where I saw people that should be running away from danger run towards it. And a lot of what we've talked about through the past couple of years, because you and I being friends for many years so far, we've talked about how sports has become like the solace and sense of peace after very difficult events. Like we're seeing that even now. I'm in New York. My town had one of the fatalities in the tropical storm Ida. The people of Louisiana and all up the Gulf Coast, the people on the West Coast with the forest fires. Like every day I have a New Orleans Saints shirt sitting on my dresser that I look at, not from this current storm, but from 2005 when Hurricane Katrina ripped through that city. I mean, the term was a terrorist act. Someone caused this all to happen. The two towers no longer exist. There is a single World Trade Center. But as we think about this segment, the walk-up song of the show segment, and we're paying tribute to the strength of New York, Kazuki, I'm gonna go. There's one song you pick, and you stop there, and you walk away. You hit play on the track, and you just step out, and you let the air play it. And the way that I'll lead into this is, I just listening to a podcast from a person that I hold very high regard. That's Katie Nolan's podcast, Sports with Katie Nolan. Her new producer for the last several months has been a man named Travis Rockhold. And he always kind of like endearingly talked about music. And Katie just asked a very pointed question in the latest episode. And she asked him, like, what does music mean to you? And one of his responses struck me as I was preparing for the segment. And he goes, 3 minutes of a song can impact your life forever. And I think about the story that led me up to like figuring out this song. So I grew up in Vermont, in New England, and we didn't have a baseball team. I didn't really like the Red Sox. I only liked the Yankees, but I had family in New York and out on Long Island. So every year, my dad made a pilgrimage every summer. It's like my treat for doing well in school. And we visit my grandmother and we go to if the Mariners were playing the Yankees, we'd go to a game. I sat in old Yankee Stadium. I saw the Mariners win several times. But one time, in one of those occasions, the Mariners were not winning. And it was the top of the ninth inning. And I begin to hear this song. And the doors open in center field. I'm like, what is going on? Because there's a legend and a lore of what happens in the Bronx on the night sky. The top of the ninth inning, when the Yankees are winning by a certain number of runs. And let me tell you that story. In 1995, the Yankees signed a player who started out being a starter in the year that, well, the Yankees lost in a very, very dramatic, very loving series, as my first episode that I ever did for this show talked about, where a pitcher came in. He pitched okay, but he was a starter. Then back down to the minors, and he came back up in 1997 until 2013. He held one single role with the New York Yankees. And that is, the Yankees led in a close game, usually the eighth and the ninth inning. The crowd would get a little bit restless, especially in 2001 as they were tracking towards, we talked about the Derek Jeter episode in the division series, but as they were leading into this series, in particular in 2001, 2002, when they were going to the World Series, the ninth inning would start. And crowd would get a little restless. And then you hear this song come off the speakers. You hear the guitar, and you know it's this very signature guitar moment. About 20 seconds later, you start hearing the foot stomping drums. It's so loud. Then it goes into this party mayhem style combination of the two. And all you hear nothing. Like the lyrics sound kind of garbled and everything, but then you hear four words that forever will change the future of that game you're about to hear. And it's exit light, enter night. You are hearing Enter Sandman. The bullpen door rips open, and then you hear the announcer come over the PA, and it's only one way to say it. Now pitching for the New York Yankees, number 42, Mariano Rivera, number 42. And then it's chaos. And it's so beautiful. To hear this song as it rips through the sky in the Bronx, because you know that you are about to see the greatest pitcher ever to play in your Yankees uniform, the only pitcher to ever get a unanimous Hall of Fame vote. And this song is Enter Sandman by Metallica. As I've said, it was written in 1991 by Kirk Hammett, Lars Ulrich, and James Hetfield. It was released on the album Metallica, though it's actually known as the Black Album. It was the first song released off this album. I'm hearing it in my head as I'm telling you this story. It's known for that guitar riff. It is just so signature to hear that guitar riff. Imagine 2001, it felt even better. The song peaked at number 16 in 1991 on the Billboard Hot 100 charts, the 5 on UK singles, certified gold for physical sales, certified platinum for digital sales. It's been used countless, countless times for popular culture for that song. In sports, it has two lives. I will say the first being for Mariano Rivera, the man, the myth, the legend. When you hear it and you hear exit light, enter night, you know it's game time. But as I learned recently, there is one other place that has such a significant thing, a school that in 2007 suffered a significant tragedy in its own right. That's Virginia Tech. I did not pay attention to this until someone brought it up to me recently. When the Virginia Tech football team, starting in 2000, comes onto the field, it's this long walk from the locker room. They come in and the students, it's Lane Stadium. It's loud. It's a football stadium. We talked about jump around last week. It's loud. And you hear, not to end a game, but to start a game, it feels like 100,000 people singing the song, stomping, jumping up and down to this song. It's magical. It is utterly magical. Take it from Yankee Stadium when it's associated with this one player to the school. That's quite good at football, but it's just incredible. And then you get into this song, and we're just so by chance releasing this episode the same time that Metallica is re-releasing the Black Album as the Metallica Blacklist, a combination of 53 artists reprising 12 songs from that album. So you will be able to hear Enter Sandman performed by Alessia Cara and The Warning, Mark DeMarco, Ghost, Juanes, who is a fantastic Latin artist, Rina Sawayama, and Weezer. I've heard the Rina Sawayama mix. It turns like a song that should not feel bright into brightness. And if we think about all the bright memories that the song brought us, like Kazuki, I'm watching him as I do this. Like, we all teared up at doing this. Like, I teared up as you caught my... This song in 2001 in particular, it showed it for years after and years before, just gave the people of New York hope. It gave them strength. It gave me strength. The fun aspect of this song that came to recently was during the middle of the pandemic, there was one of the vaccination mega sites was within a couple miles of my house. And I drove by it one time. And the pandemic as itself, even today, is really scary. And you always wonder, like, how can you make something scary not feel scary? And the mix of songs that I got driving up to this place as I was driving by it was pretty incredible. I got Tiny Dancer by Elton John, which is a great song. And it, then like the station like had like a skip. And I was like, what's going to come next? I have no idea. And then as I turned past this massive building, the guitar starts. Then the drums. And then you hear the words. And even though that song is about something ending, it will give, it provides like a, it provides so much hope. And it's just a magical song. It's the best song other than and the next one is probably Hell's Bells for Trevor Hoffman. But like I said, that song is, I'm watching, Suki and I are getting emotional as we talk about this because it means so much to us. Because you could be a Yankees fan for his life and me just watching this game and these players. But that's the song of the show. It's why we created this segment, honestly. And as we go into 9/11, like that's what it means. But we'll end with how 9/11 and baseball are tied together forever. And I have outlined four memories on this. And if Kazuki, our wonderful, the wonderful mix master and producer of this podcast, along with me, I get to talk, builds the whole thing from the back end. Maybe you'll get to hear one of these moments. And if I'll allude to this fact, if there's one moment I want to hear, I'll get to it in a second, about there's a moment that I every year on September 11th, I watch these four clips every year, without a doubt. The first is that Joe Buck, who we all kind of ridicule slightly for his calls on Fox Sports. He was actually a good stand-in Jeopardy host, I will say that. The first game back for the Cardinals, Jack Buck, his father, used to be the play-by-play call announcer for the Cardinals. Jack Buck comes in. Jack Buck, being a great broadcaster, is a wordsmith of sorts. And he wrote a poem called For America, and he stood at the mic at the base of Old Busch Stadium and read it.
I don't know about you, but as for me, the question has already been answered. Should we be here? Yes.
And it's the poem is punctuated by this line at the end. It says, should we be here today? Yes. And the crowd just erupts. That was the first day back of games in 2001, September 17th. And then we'll go in chronological order. The next is my favorite. September 21st, 2001, the first game back of any professional sports team between football and baseball in New York. Mets are playing the Braves. Bomb of the eighth inning. I'm not sure who got on base beforehand, but Steve Carsey is on the mound. A name that I will always remember. He's pitching to Mike Piazza. And Piazza having a pretty tough at bat. And the broadcaster, Sarah, I think it was Howie Rose. It's like, we need a home run. It's like, it's very simple. Get a home run. And Carsey throws a pitch right down the middle.
It away. And it's hit deep to left center. Andrew Jones on the run. This one has a chance. Home run! Mike Piazza and the Mets lead 3-2.
And Mike Piazza absolutely unloads one into the dark sky of Queens. And it's the title of this episode. This one has a chance. Home run and dead air. Howie Rosen with just this amazing call that we all needed to hear. Like, all we needed as an American was a chance to like redeem ourselves, rebuild ourselves. And that call, I mean, Mike Piazza, as just like I am right now, as he was recounting it during his Hall of Fame induction speech, just lost it. because he did it. I think he couldn't figure out, we couldn't unmuscle the gravity of what it meant right then and there. But years and years looking back on it, it changed the face of a city, of a country with a one hit of a bat. I'm not sure I remember anything else from that game of that home run. And it was a great call. And it was just so spectacular. It goes into the old Shea Stadium where the apple was. There was an apple that would come out and the home run literally dropped straight there, right there. And then as you continue throughout the year, the Yankees made it to the World Series. They played the Diamondbacks. Game three, the Yankees are playing Diamondbacks at Yankee Stadium. And President George W. Bush is going to throw out the first pitch.
For tonight's ceremonial first pitch, and please welcome the President of the United States.
And there's a ESPN film, and he's the whole nation. He's not shot or taken down on the mound. He's going to be vulnerable as ever, just standing out there 60 feet, 6 inches from the next closest person. He puts on a bulletproof vest and he's in the batting cages before the game, throwing darts, just every pitch he can get. And there's one thing he said to himself. It's don't bounce it. Whatever you do, don't bounce it. To my friends who are baseball fans, this was one of their favorite baseball memories, because politics aside, to watch someone go out there in under the most dire of scary circumstances of like the President of the United States is going to stand out there completely unchecked and throw out a pitch. Was a perfect strike. Didn't bounce. Perfect strike. That was game three. And then because of September 11th, we moved to Halloween. Next day, October 31st, 2001. Game four. And Joe Buck is behind the mic. And the clock ticks to 12:01 a.m. We have never been here before, ladies and gentlemen. We are playing in November. We are playing baseball in November. And Derek Jeter's up to bat. And he's facing the sidewinding, submarine throwing Byung-Hyun Kim, one of the best pitchers on the staff of a very good staff of the Arizona Diamondbacks. And Derek Jeter hits a pretty loud shot.
And the 3-2 pitch. Swung on a drill to right field. Going back, Sanders. On the track. At the wall. See ya! See ya! See ya! A home run by Derek Jeter. He pumps his fist in the air as he rounded first. He'll hit on third base. He high-fives Willie Randolph. And the entire Yankee team mobs him at home plate as he leaps onto the dish with a 4-3 Yankee win.
Goes over the wall, and we had Mr. October, Jackson. We end our episode today. Derek Jeter going into the Hall of Fame, but on a night in 2001, the early, early morning hours of November 1st, we met Mr. November. And with that, we wish you all a safe, reflective holiday on September 11th. We'll see you again in a couple of weeks.
That's it for this episode of Sayonara Baseball. This episode of Sayonara Baseball is hosted and produced by me, Kazuki Akiba, and Brandon Beiser. This episode was edited by Kazuki Akiba with additional research by Brandon Beiser. Our theme song is by Kay Margus. Sayonara Baseball is a production of Daylight and Media 3 Limited. We'll be back with another episode. If you like this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast as more people will know about this show. Go to daylightinteractive.com to see some exclusive updates and more about our upcoming shows. I'm Kazuki Akiba.
And I'm Brandon Beiser.
And this has been Sayonara Baseball.